Welcome to the 8 p.m. Saturday night speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Tom. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Welcome to the 41st anniversary of Howl Place. Warren R., original member of Howl Place, is going to come up, give us a little history, and right after that, Bill will read how it works.
Yeah, by the time I get up here, the meeting will be over. Sorry, Patty. I'm Warren. I'm a drug and alcoholic. It's an honor to be up here, and I want to thank a couple people that they did leave out. Maybe Austin for being the parking sheriff. So, if you're blocked in, you're staying for the whole meeting. That's you're not moving. So, anyway, but just gonna give you a little bit of history of the Howl Place. I came to Georgia on July 5th of 1983, and but Howl Place opened. First meeting was March 24th, 1983, and we were on 92, Highway 92. Anybody who knows where that building with the spider is, yep. that was a Howl Place, the original Howl Place, and the founder. There were seven people that founded Howl Place. That were involved in the beginning. The main one was Pat W. This was his vision, and he got these other people together. But there was Pat W., Don Roberts, Jim Hicks, Tony Dreck, and Rose Arnold, and Fred and Marion. I can never remember their last name. They moved to Tennessee. Them were the seven people that made it possible for us to be here tonight like this. And I don't know if they're... any of them are alive anymore, you know, but I'm grateful for them. I want to go ahead. Pat was real big on the days you were sober, and my first home group was the original hall group, and Pat would sit right there at this middle table, and he chaired every Sunday. We do the steps, one step a week, and we go right through them. And Pat would never call on anybody. He'd have his head down. If you raised your hand, he wouldn't call on you. He was just a gruff old man, you know, just a mean old bastard, if you know him. And he got worse as he got older. Anyway, I loved him. Today, he would have been sober 62 years and 10 months, and that equals 22,951 days. On his memorial paper, he had 16,040 days when he died. So, anyway, Pat would say, "Yeah, right." Anybody knew him? Anything you see? Yeah, right. So, anyway, yeah, right, Pat. I love you, miss you, and I'm not going to take up all of your time. I'm going to take up most of it. I've never heard you speak before, but I do know that I'm funnier than you. So, anyway. Yeah, right. That's a good one. Yeah, right. So anyway, that's how Howl Place started. And we moved over here like 5 years after the Howl Place opened, 4 or 5 years. And everything you see here, this used to be, this half of the building was a arcade, all black walls. The other half was a pawn shop. They had a fence up, top of the roof, all the way up. And we moved over here. We were paying $400 a month on 92. We moved here to $1,100 a month for one half. And then about 6 or 8 months later, we got the other half for another $1,100. And we didn't know where the hell we were going to get the money. Pat always said, God will take care of them things. And you know, as you can see tonight, we own the building, you know. We don't have to pay rent anymore. I tried to charge a couple people for the dinner. know. I didn't get any money though, and one guy was going to give me some money, and I said, "I'm just messing with you." But anyway, Patty, I'm going to leave you 5 minutes, honey. So you're going to have to be quick. Anyway, I don't think I have really anything else to say. Just
keep talking.
Huh? Just what?
Keep talking.
Keep talking? Yeah. And I want to thank Adam for being Adam. No other reason. He doesn't do shit. But he's Adam. So, anyway. And if anyone has a white Tesla, if they could move it, you're blocking someone in. So, Josie, you got a white Tesla? All right. Anyway, thank you for allowing me to be up here tonight. So.
So our speaker today, Patty, she was almost an old timer when I got here. You know, and I heard these guys like Patty and don't laugh, Jeff, and Elliot, my first sponsor, and some of these guys, they sounded like geniuses. I'm like, my God, they know so much. And then I find out they're coming out of this book, you know, our program of recovery, and it's just so simple. And Patty's always been like, she's been a voice of reason. She's a woman of conviction, accomplished, amazing woman. She's been through a lot in recovery, and she walked through with grace and dignity, was a light for other people, and just shows people how it can be done. Patty.
Keep my composure. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Wow, what a filled room. I am just so grateful and blessed to be in a wonderful room of recovering people from all walks of life. There's 11 or 12 people that I've known here a long, long time. And every one of you means so much to me. And thank you for the board of directors and for Tom Call. When he called me, I said, "You want me to do what?" And I was just so honored, you know, just so honored and looking so forward to this and so excited. And you have a wonderful place here, a wonderful place of enthusiasm, recovery, and staying here. And that's what it's all about. I have a story that, you know, that is... remarkable in many ways to me. I should be dead. I should not be standing here. I got hit this program when I was a little over 19. So everybody thought I got here when I was 2. And so I got here when I was 19 years old. And, you know, I've stayed. And I've stayed through some hard times in recovery, some hard times. But every one of those hard times has given me serenity through all the adversity that I've been through. It's given me grace and dignity. It has showed me that I can stay clean and sober through anything in my life. And I don't have to drink. I don't have to pick up a needle. I don't have to pick up a pot. You know, and I know this is a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm going to tell you something. If people told me I couldn't come to AA because I was a junkie, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be standing here. And I came here broken. Neil's got a year more than me. He's been a best friend to me for a long, long time. He's walked with me through things. We used to drive around 285 and talk all night. I don't know what we talked about, but it kept me clean and it kept me in the middle of the herd. So the thing about my life is that I grew up in an alcoholic home. My daddy was an alcoholic. My mother was a teetotaler. She was your typical Southern garden belle. Okay, everything was proper, and I grew up here in Atlanta, Georgia. I was born in Tennessee. I lived in Tennessee until Chattanooga, so I was about 3 or 4. We moved to Atlanta. I went to R.L. Hope Elementary. I graduated from North Fulton High School in Buckhead, and I ran amok. I didn't really want to go to school, but I knew if I didn't go to school, I wouldn't graduate. But the whole time I was in school, I was drinking, using black beauties, shooting cocaine, and I was doing that when I was 15 years old. I used to hang out at Piedmont Park with the Allman Brothers and knew Dwayne and dated him for a short time. He died in 71. I knew Greg and I knew a lot of the people. I had a girlfriend that was going to Woodstock and I wanted to go. And my mother says, "You're not going anywhere." And I had a little plastic flowered suitcase packed, you know. And she says, "You're not going anywhere." I left home after school, after I graduated from high school. I went to a fashion college and design college for a short period of time. I quit that and I left and I joined this guy that was dodging Vietnam, and I hitchhiked to California. And I was a little over 17 years old after I graduated. And I came out to California to Laguna Beach, and I lived in this wonderful place, the caves. These natural caves, because I had no other place to go. And this guy stayed with me for a short period of time. He says, "Bye-bye, I'm off to see a girlfriend." I said, "Goodbye." And I ended up on the streets really bad. I got busted quite often, and I had no ID. I remember going up the San Juan Capistrano, up in the Ortega Mountains, and I was with three guys, and two guys died in the car and went off 150 feet off a cliff, and I'm lucky to be alive. I've overdosed four times. Anyway, those are stories that a lot of us have been through, and I don't ever want to forget them, because if I forget them, I'll be condemned to relive it again. And I don't want to forget where I come from, and that's why I tell that story. But there's so much of my recovery. Thank God, there's more recovery for me than there was when I was out there using and drinking. You know, God had saved me from going down any more self-destruction than I'd already been. I was on my way to prison, to Chino Rehabilitation for Women out in Santa Ana. And I got busted for selling drugs to an undercover agent. And and that was the third time I'd been in jail. And I called my daddy. I said, "Would you please help me and get me out of jail?" And he says, "Absolutely not. You can rot in jail as far as I'm concerned." And I said, "Why is that?" He says, you're breaking my mother up. You're breaking me up, and I can't do it anymore." And he says, "I quit drinking, and I joined Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "I'm screwed." I thought, "Oh, no, I can't manipulate him anymore. He won't help me anymore." So every 2 weeks, I got to make a phone call. I was there 8 weeks until he said, "Okay, I'll help you if you come home to Georgia." I said, "Okay," and I didn't really want to go, but I did. I knew that the only prayer I ever made is, "God, help me, get me out of this. I won't do it again." And so he did come out and get me, and then we left, and I came back to Atlanta, and I started all over again. I was hanging out at the Strip before I left. I hung out at the Strip after I left. And I was selling the Great Speckled Bird, working at this wonderful place called Sexy Sadie's, and going to the Aurora and all the free clinics, and hung out with a lot of different people at White Columns and places I shouldn't even be at, and I was hanging out there, and I could have gotten killed. I witnessed a girl getting killed and several people overdosing on the streets. I got on methadone for a while. It was not a good scene. And I drank constantly all the way through. I stole money at the Lowe's Grand Theater that I worked at for a period of time. And I almost got in trouble for that. Almost got raped for that. And I ran and ran and ran until I got to my place where I lived. And it wasn't until about 5 weeks later, and it was hot, hot summer in Georgia, and it was July, and something happened to me. I don't know why it happened this time, but it did. I was in this little apartment on Old 10th Street behind the Rexall drugstore. I was living there. I couldn't even pay $80 a month for rent. And I was staying there and just sweating it out. And I had booze all over the floor. And my bed was on the floor. So, and I was sick and I was thin. I weighed like 126 pounds and I was 6 feet tall and had long hair and it was about six different colors. And I was just gaunt looking and a terrible mess. And I don't know what happened, but I had that spiritual experience. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, because for me, I would have died. I never liked myself. I hated myself. I didn't feel comfortable on the inside of my skin. And I didn't want to live. Those are combinations of what my life was like. And I was scared, but I never would show you the fear that I was scared. I had to be tough because I didn't want anyone to know who I really was on the inside, that I was a broken little girl, an adolescent kid who didn't know anything about life. But I didn't want you to know that. Now, you probably already knew that, but I didn't want to show it. And so I wanted to change, and I didn't know what that was about. And I used to pray, but I didn't know how to pray. I remember my mother sending me Billy Graham articles, you know. She'd send them out to me, and she'd go, you know, please get right with Jesus and all this other stuff. And I couldn't understand that because I'd have these neon signs that would go off and say, well, you would do, you know, Jesus is watching you, you know, be careful, you know. And I'd have those little neon signs that go off because I had a conscience, but I didn't listen to that conscience. It wasn't important to me. More important to me was getting high, keeping my sanity, and drinking and using kept my sanity. And so I was 19. I felt like I was 50. I looked like I was 50. I thought, my life, I'm never going to live to see my 21st birthday. I might as well just die. The next morning, I rose. I never looked at myself in the mirror. I did not like what I saw in the mirror. It scared me to death to look there. And for the first time, I got up and I don't know why. I got up and I said, you know, I really, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. Please help me. And I swear, he said, I'm here to help you. I'm here to help you. And I went in the bathroom and I looked at myself and I went, oh, I do need help. I'm really in bad shape. And so I got up and I didn't have, I don't know where my clothes were. I lost my clothes. Couldn't figure out where all my clothes went. And I guess they got stolen or something. I don't know. Maybe I sold them. I don't really remember. I was in a blackout most of the time. So I went up to behind the store and put a 10 cents, wherever I got that off the floor, probably because I didn't have any money, and put that in the heavy pound phone. And I made that phone call to my mom, and I said, I want to come home. She's heard that before, like a little girl crying wolf. And she says, if you do come home, things will have to change. And I said, okay. I just went, okay. And I said, do whatever it takes. And so I went and stood on the street between Peachtree Street, right in front of the Rexall drugstore. And my mother sent a cab. I had on a nightgown because I didn't know where my clothes were. I had a nightgown on and that little plastic flowered case. And I didn't have hardly anything in it. And so the cab driver picked me up, took me home to our address. I walked in the door, and my mother and I had a kind of a tumultuous relationship. I think my whole life was about rebelling against her because I couldn't get her approval. You know, that's the rebellion that I had. And she opened the door, and she looked at me and started crying. And I started crying, and I said, I mean it this time. I'm sincere. And she says, well, when your daddy gets home, we'll talk more. I said, fine. So we had dinner, and he's pulled out this little 24-hour book. And he says, we're going to read this. And I said, okay. So he started to read it. And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, now we're going to go to an AA meeting. And I said, oh, I don't want to go. You know, he goes, I can't live here. There's the street. There's the door. You can leave right now. And I said, no, I don't have any place to go. And I said, well, I don't have any clothes to wear. It's a big deal. And my mother says, there's a little dress in the closet you had when you were 16. Wear that. So I did, a little white dress. And I went to the Biscayne room. That was my first meeting I ever went to. And that room meant a lot to me because the room kind of shook, is all I remember, because there was a railroad station right next to it. And it would shake, and I was shaking, and I was sitting next to my daddy. And so when the guy was speaking at a podium like this, he was talking about how he was a phony and how he almost lost his job and this, that, and the other. And I thought, I don't have a job. And I didn't really identify with him. But what I did feel was the room. I could feel the room full of love, of care, and I wondered what that was really about. How come everybody was smiling? How could they smile when they got a problem like this, you know? And I'd sit there crying, so mine was felt quite worse for me because I was so into myself. And so I walked up and I got there. I says, anybody has a desire to stop drinking? At that time, there was no other fellowships to go to. I said, sure. And I went up there and I got a little white chip and I sat down, and everybody after the meeting, people were swarming me. We said, we're so glad you're here. We heard so much about you. And I went, oh, no. because my daddy had talked about me and said, I have a junkie Alkie daughter. She's way out in California. I don't know where she is. And this kind of thing I'm sure he was talking about. I bailed her out of jail. She keeps doing the same thing over and over again. and I didn't know how to take that. And I remember, I just remember there was some younger people there. Bobby was there. He was detoxing there. So back then, you could detox there. If you made a 12-step call, you would stay with the person, and you had a little cot in the back room, and they shook it out, and you were responsible, if a 12-stepper, to stay with that person. And they used to give Dilantin. Can you believe that? Uh-huh. Yeah, for detoxing. Yeah, that would not go well today. And so I thought, wow, people really do care. When they told me about this a few weeks later, I said, gee, that they really, my daddy said, I detoxed there once. And Maggie, who, she was a great lady there, she says, she helped me a lot when I was detoxing there before. I went, oh, okay. And then we all went on to the NABA club that night. I put my white chip on the top of the, on the top of the car, and there, it went down the register, and I had to get another white chip. So I have that same white chip, but it's not white anymore. It's yellow. You know, they kind of turned on it, yeah. But it's always a gratitude chip that I have. That's the most special chip that I ever had. And then the gal and the guy that are here for their 4 days, spot 1 day, you stay here, and you occupy that seat, and you put your name on that seat, and don't you ever leave. This is the most important thing in your life. Most important thing in your life, and it's the most important thing in my life every day that I occupy a seat in whatever recovery program that I'm going to, and that I feel belonged, because that's the first thing I wanted to feel. Is I wanted to feel loved, I wanted to feel belonged, and I wanted to feel accepted, because I did not accept myself, I never felt belonged, and I always played the victim. But poor me, if you only been through what I've been through, you wouldn't do this, you wouldn't live the way you live. But I couldn't get out of the way I lived, because it's the only way I knew. I didn't know any difference, because I was very naive. And so I went to the NABA club, and I met Bobby Joe and some other people. And then I met this lady there, and she became my sponsor, Lillian. She became my sponsor for a short period of time. And I told her, I don't think I'm really an alcoholic. You know, and she goes, well, why is that? I said, I did a lot of drugs. I don't really see. She says, it doesn't matter. Even she told me that. She says, it doesn't matter. Did you drink? I said, yeah. She says, did you drink for the same reason you use drugs? I said, yeah. She says, well, there you go. There's your answer. You know, so I identified myself always as an alcoholic and addict, because I am. I'm both, you know, and it really doesn't matter what the addiction is, you know. If it changed the way you felt, the way you acted, and the self-destructive behavior, you know, it did all the same things. No matter how I used the drug, whether I shot it, used pills, wherever I put it, whatever I drank, it doesn't matter. You know, it was all an addiction. One's too many, a thousand enough. I couldn't stop. I could not stop at one for any reason at all. I didn't want to. Higher the better. So when I went there and I saw her, and she told me all this, this is what she told me, all this stuff I'm sharing with you. She said, I want you to come to a meeting that I go to, and I think you're going to really like it. And I said, okay. So I went to some meetings with her, and at the NABA club, she wanted to start a meeting that's called Problems Other Than Drugs. I'll never forget this. And the board of directors says, you can't have a meeting like that here, you know. And so she had it anyway for a short period of time. And then they told her she couldn't. No. So she took her somewhere else and started having a meeting together. I'll never forget that. But I got actively involved in young people's. I got actively involved in young people's of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1973, I got the experience of going to San Francisco, to IKIPA, and it really turned me on. I was on fire. I went with a girlfriend named Judy. She was an unhappy marriage, and we got ourselves in some trouble. You know, girl meets boy on AA campus, you know, kind of thing, and got myself in a little trouble there. But otherwise, you know, I tell people this. I met my first husband and my third husband there.
Not at the same time.
No. I met my first husband, who a lot of people in here knew. and he helped a lot of people, and he was a lot older than me. He came to Atlanta in 74, we kind of hooked up, and in 76 we got married, and one of my friends here was in both of my weddings. And my daddy did not want me to marry this man. He says he doesn't have the things that you need or want. And I said, well, how does he know that? And he was talking about finances, jobs, you know, basic things that you need to have, cars, that kind of thing. I went ahead and married him, and I realized after I did that maybe my daddy was right. But I was kind of codependent, naive, and young at 25 with 4.5 years of recovery, and I said, oh, I can fix this. Mm-hmm. I know I'll get him in shape. Mm-hmm. And he'll work with me, and that never happened. So I'm not here to take his inventory, but I learned a lot in that marriage, and I'll tell you the things that I learned. I learned to stand up for myself. I learned how to say no. I learned how to recognize that I needed to grow up. I realized that then what I was doing, I was solving my problems at my work. What I did made up who I was, and I was not paying attention to my own recovery, to be honest with you. In 73, I was kind of dating this guy, and his mother was going to be working at a hospital, and she was going to be a charge nurse. And he said, you need to go talk to my mother, Alice, and they're looking for counselors at this new hospital called Peachford Hospital. And I think they'll hire you. And I said, well, how would you know they would hire me? I don't have a degree. They said, because I'm sure that, you know, they're just getting started, and you're young, and they probably will hire you. I said, okay. So I went over there and I talked to her, and she said, yes, you had an appointment with Conway Hunter, who's going to be in charge. He wants to see you. I went down and talked with him, and he says, welcome aboard. Hardly even knew me, but knew me when I did come in, because my daddy took me to him when he was on his own private practice to help me to see if I needed any medical help. And he did remember me. And he says, I'm so glad you got over a year's sobriety. He says, welcome aboard. We don't all of us know what we're doing. We're going to start from fresh. There's no treatment centers for alcoholism or addiction here. So we welcome you. So I started working there in 73. And I only had a year and a half of recovery. I was 21 years old or something like that. And so we all started together. And later I did get some credentials. I thought that would be important. But at that time, I learned so much. It was so much fun. We didn't even have a lab. We were doing lab work, but we didn't have a lab on site. They sent it out to Dunwoody Medical. And I remember Dr. Scott, he says, can you come in here and help me? I can't find this lady's vein. I'll never forget that. And I said, well, this will work right here, you know. And we didn't know anything. We didn't know what we were doing. Yeah, it's a true story. And so I got promoted. I was there like, let's see, maybe 3 years maybe. And they said, we want you to be a senior counselor. You have leadership skills. And I thought, I do? And they said, yes, you do. And I was real happy about that, and I pursued that. It gave me self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth, and I enjoyed working and did what I did for a lot of years. I really enjoyed it. I love helping people, and I love problem solving. You know, I think it's just sort of my nature. And I went back, and we started the GACO, which is the Georgia Addiction Counselors Association, and I became the certification board chair. And you know, everything I've done is started from scratch, because we had no information back then, you know, to give people. So I've been grateful for that. It's one of my part of my journeys of recovery. We had started having a lot of meetings there. You could come to a big meeting at 5:30 and eat for a dollar at the cafeteria. Yeah, kind of cool. And we had people like Father Martin come and share on Chalk Talk many years ago. And that's where I really learned about crossing that invincible line, that there's no going back. Once you're an addict, you're an addict, or an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. I learned so much from that. So that was my generation when I came in. We had No in Narcotics Anonymous, and I will speak on that because it's a part of my story. There was no NA meetings around, and Joe Hubbard came up to me, and he was a pain, but he came up to me and he goes, "You need to start NA and get drug addicts out of Alcoholics Anonymous." I'll never forget him telling me that. And I said, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." He says, "Well, you should know. You're a drug addict." And I said, "Yes, and I'm also an alcoholic. Why?" And he goes, "Well, we just need to find a place for them to go." I said, "I know nothing about it." And he goes, "Well, you never heard of it?" I said, "No, I've heard of Neurotics Anonymous." "I never heard of it." And he says, "Well," he says, "you and that boyfriend of yours," he's talking about Chuck at the time, you know, he's a big shot. You go get him and he'll help you." And so I called Charlie Dietrich out of Synanon, and, you know, and then finally we found somebody and we started our first NAA meeting in 1974 there. That was our first AA meeting in the Southeast. And so I was a part of that. And I've been a part of a lot of startup things. I don't know why, but it's the, like I said, I think it was the time. We're always in the right time and the right place for where we're supposed to be, no matter where we are. And I've been grateful for those experiences. I'm going to move on. My story's long, and we don't hear all night, but I do have some other things that have happened to me that in my sobriety that I do want to talk about, because just because we're in recovery doesn't mean everything's glorious. It doesn't mean that everything's going to go the right way that we want it to go. It means that we're going to have pain. And I had a lot of pain in sobriety. A lot of it was my own making. A lot of it was powerless. You know, we're powerless over people that pass and grieve, and we grieve. And I've had a lot of grief in recovery. My father was my inspiration. He was my best friend. And and that was in 1983, and I was down at Fun in the Sun. And thank you. I was down at Fun in the Sun, and I was going to our convention down there. And my husband wasn't there yet. He was going to fly down or drive down. I don't know what the deal was. I couldn't remember. And there's a guy here tonight, and his daddy, John, came up running to me on the sand. He says, "You have to go home." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Your daddy just died." And I saw him the day before, and I said, "I'm going to be coming down to Fun in the Sun. I'm supposed to go down because I'm a part of this." And he goes, "I want you to go." He says, "You need to go. I'll be all right." And I gave him a red rose. And I remember, and I was talked a lot about this today at the earlier workshop, and I was reading part of the little acceptance book, and that little book he wanted me to bring to him because he says, "This is what I need. I have to work on my acceptance of where I'm going." And I don't know if I didn't pay attention to it. I didn't want to listen to it. And he says, "I'm going to have to take some narcotics. I hope that doesn't bother you." And I said, "Well, I'm not the one that's taking them." You know? He was kind. He had a lot of humility. And he was very loving. And he was the only copy of the book that I'd ever seen. If he hadn't showed that to me, I wouldn't be living today. He used to come down and see me down at the strip, and he goes, "I want to show you what I've received in the program." And he'd show me his chips. And I thought he was talking about AAA, you know, and I didn't understand it was AA. And I'd just say, "Give me $50. So I wanted to get high. I wanted to drink. I wanted to get high. I made my amends to my parents the best that I could, you know. I made some financial restitution to my parents after I got the job at the hospital. I wasn't making a lot of money. I think I started out at $2.20. But, you know, as I moved on, I got promoted there. And I remember being called in, and they said, "We want to open up an outpatient program, and we want you to be the director." And I went, "Wow, really?" And they said, "Yes, we want you to be a director. You've been with us since the inception of 73, and we want you. We've grown here a lot. You know what we're about, and you'll have some other people here that will help you, but we want you to do it." So I wrote policies and procedures for the outpatient program, and I got promoted, and I stayed working in there for almost 27 years. They were very, very helpful to me after my husband divorced. He left me, actually. My first husband left me and walked out. kind of left me dry financially. I was really shattered by that, but I moved on and I held my head up as high as I could during that time. And I continued to work, and I just made work more important than anything else, and that's probably not what I should have done. I knew that my recovery was my priority. I didn't ever think about drinking or using through any adversity that I've gone through. I've always wanted to know what's the solution and how can I feel better and how can I get out of this, you know, emotionally, because I wanted to have a better attitude. So I went to some counseling for myself, outside help. And then I met my second husband, my third husband, and I got together, he was not my husband at the time. And he says, you know, I have to tell you that Chuck did you a favor by leaving you. He did you a favor. And I said, yeah, I guess I got to look at it that way. So we fell in love. and we didn't talk about getting married or anything. I bought a house. And I was very happy for that. You know, I lived in apartments and I bought a house and I lived in Roswell. And I was very happy doing that and felt like, you know, I was growing up in the world, so to speak. And then I continued on to work and we were together for a short 9 months. And he says, I can't stay here because my children are going to miss me too much. And my little boy says, Daddy, 3,000 miles is too far away and I'll only see you twice a year. And says, I got to go back home. Broke my heart, but he was the catalyst. I had a nervous breakdown at 15 and a half years of recovery. I got suicidal. I didn't want to live. And I didn't tell many people about that because I was too scared and I had a lot of shame and guilt about how I felt, because somebody that has this length of time should never feel that way. And I had false pride. And I told Timothy, he's my husband now, but I told him at that time with Bill, who died, a good friend of ours, I said, I'm going to go somewhere different. I'm going to get out of where I work and I'm going to take a sabbatical. So I checked myself in. I called in, you know, like know-it-all here. I was going to assess myself, you know, and that's the worst thing you can do. And I said, you know, I can't live this way anymore, and I feel out of control. I feel like I'm spinning and I'm very depressed and I'd like to get some help. And I told them about myself and whatever. So they did an assessment on the phone. They said, when do you want to come? And I said, anytime, you know, I'll work it out. So I called to their director, human resources. I talked to the physician that was there, talked to Conway about it. And I said, you know, I need to go away for a while. And they said, whatever you need to do, we love you and we'll continue to pay you. Whatever you need, we're here for you. And I left and I ended up in Sierra Tucson in Tucson, Arizona for codependency treatment. And I didn't know much about codependency. I know we had started it at the hospital, but I didn't understand it that well. And I'd already gone to therapy and counseling and talked to my therapist about it. And he says, whatever I can do to support you. So I stayed there for 31 days. And they told me that degrees have thermometers. And we want you to leave your degree out the door. And we want you to focus on yourself. And I said, well, okay. And I said, but why am I in detox? You know? And I said, I got 15 years. And they said, you're detoxing from control. Mm-hmm. And that really made sense to me. Your defenses, you're detoxing from control. You're emotionally a mess. And you're here to get some emotional recovery under your belt. And I said, that's true. That's very true. So I stayed in group. And then my husband, well, he's not my husband, Timothy came out for family week. I was there with a couple of celebrities. A lot of people went there that, you know, were those. And I left there and I went right back to work. They told me you needed to get out of the treatment business and get something else to do. And it's all that I knew and I didn't want to do it. But I came home and I went back into work and went back to work for some years. I finally changed that. I finally said, no, I need to change it up. So I went into another passion that I love, which is interior design. And I've been doing that ever since. And I have a freelance business of interior design, and I enjoy it when I can and when I do it. I'm not as young as I used to be, but I still have passions. You know, I still have passions for recovery, and do a lot of sponsorship, and I do a lot of reading, and And during COVID, we had a really tough time, and we read a women's group. And I started a women's group on Zoom, and we read seven different books. And we read everything under the sun to help and to get intimate with one another. And I may have read that book and read different books, basic texts, a big book, whatever. I read them over and over again, but something was clicking different in my life. And why it was clicking different in my life? Because I had a different surrender. I had some surrenders that I needed to go through. And I found myself, I needed to get more teachable. I needed to get more open-minded. I needed to change some things about my life. And the 6 and 7 step is what I worked on constantly to change things about my life, because my defects were really kind of showing. I was more into myself because I wasn't with people, and I knew that I needed to change those defects of character into something that was more of an asset. So I worked hard on that. And I love my sponsees. I went to there tonight, and I love her dearly, and I love all my old friends dearly. Every one of you, I can make a story out of everyone here, the about 12 of you that I've known for a very, very long time. And I found myself feeling so at home here. I feel like, you really know me. You really know me. And, I've lived in California for 21 years. And when I moved out there, and I did marry this man, Timothy, I had a second husband in between Tom, and he and I were
not good. This Tom.
No, 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 another Tom. Anyway, Tom H. And I was married to him for 10 years, my first husband 12 years, and then I've been married, 21 years to my third one. So you calculate all that together. I've been married most of my recovery, but I had to learn to know myself and learn how to be alone for it. Now, I learned as much as I could for a short period of time about myself with being single, but I'm really very happy in my marriage. I have a loving husband. Last year, he just went through cancer, and he had larynx cancer, and he had 37 radiations and 7 chemos. I've had hip surgery last year, so all of this is part of getting older, but if you stay here long enough, these things are going to happen to you. It's part of life. It's part of life. I mean, you see old friends, well, what surgery did you have yesterday, And you go, and you just realize that, it's just what we do when we have when we're older in recovery. I think that for me, that the thing that's most important in my life, in my recovery, is that working with others. If I'm not working with other people, then because this is a self-centered disease and I need to get out of myself, I have to work with other people. Whether it's someone just calls me and says, you got a moment to just talk. You don't have to sponsor them. You got a minute to just talk. Or you go and greet the newcomer, and because you are the most important person in this meeting tonight. We give it away to keep it here. And this afternoon, I was talking about The Professor and the Paradox, and I grew up on the second edition, and I love that, and I'll say it again. We surrender to win. It's the only program where we get up, we give up, and we get so much more. We give it away to keep it. If we didn't give it away to keep it, we wouldn't know how to change. We would know what to do. You help me as much as I help you. No matter how long or how much time we have here, doesn't matter. And then the other thing that I love about recovery is that I know that I'm not judged here. I know that you understand me, you've accepted me, you've loved me when I couldn't love myself. And that is when I was new, and that's even today. It's even today, The other stuff that I've gone through is I've gone through all the 12 steps many times. I've gone through several inventories. The last inventory I did was on trust, learning how to trust again, learning how to, work on my issues that I have had difficult times with, learning how to open up to people, because sometimes when you get some time, you go, I've been there, I already know that. I know what to do, and then you realize that you're still in your self-centeredness. You're not opening up to other people for them to help you. And we need as much help, even though we've been here a long time, as you do when you're brand new. We're all talking about the same language here. It's the language of the heart. And when they say feelings aren't facts, that may be true. But if we don't share our feelings, we can't change. It's important that we share our feelings. No matter how little or big or how small or how minute we think they are or how silly we think they are, I think it's so important to share them. Because don't you want to give them power? You don't want to give those feelings that are power, their power, because some of those feelings you think are more, you're harder on yourself than you are on others, and sometimes they're negative. And when I have negative feelings about myself, then I can get into a deep depression. And then my old sponsor would say, "You want a fur-lined pity pot?" You know, I would say, "No, I don't want one of those anymore. I think I've outgrown those." Thank you. But there's a lot of times that, you know, that does happen in our lives. And the only thing we can get out of is get out of self. Self will run riot. That's the root of my problem. Self-centeredness, self-seeking behavior. You know, they talk about the promises in recovery, right? And the new freedom and new happiness, I felt that when I walked in the door. I felt that. I felt like I wasn't alone anymore. That was a freedom. I hadn't done the first step yet, but yet I had. Because I wouldn't be sitting in here. I wouldn't be at my first meeting if I didn't think that I had a problem. You know, that I was powerless and that my life's unmanageable. And then in far as the second step is concerned, I try not to do the same thing over again expecting different results. I know where that's going to get me. Nowhere. So what I want to do to stay sane is I want to do sane and esteemable things. And what are those esteemable things? I want to think about you. I want to think about how to help you. I want to think about what your needs are. And I want to be available. And then the third step, which says we made a decision. It said we make it. We made it. And I think we made it because I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. It's the first things that people told me. You know, I don't have to go back to basics if I don't get away from them. It's been my story. And it's easy to get away from simple things because we got a complicated thinking up here, you know. We don't listen to anything that thing says up there because it's sometimes going to lie to you. And it has lied to me many times. So I have turned it over to God and I'm asking God for help. And I love the third step prayer. I love any kind of prayer that's going to help me to show that I have more faith in God that has faith in me when I don't have faith in myself. And I've had that in recovery too, with grief. Feeling like I didn't know how to change some things. And I have had confusion. And I'll admit it, you know, it's fine. And I had to go to somebody and say, "Can you help me? I'm a little confused here. Can you answer my questions?" I go there to get my questions answered. And my sponsor has been a wonderful lady. I have some wonderful women in my life. Oh, my God. Wonderful women. I had a birthday when I moved to California. I had 30 years. I felt like a newcomer when I was there. And they took me by hand, and some lady said, "You're going to find comfort here. Come with me to this women's meeting. I want to introduce you to everyone. These are some new friends for you." She was so kind. And I celebrated many birthdays now. And when I had my 45th birthday, there were 200 people there. 200 people. And I got the most beautiful gifts of love. I mean, I got some physical gifts. They gave me a beautiful bracelet. I wear it. I never take it off. It's got links around it, and it's reminding of how we link together, how we circle together. We're always in a circle of life and recovery, and we always will be there for each other, no matter what is going on. We've had a few losses, and I've gone to a few funerals. One lady died in her sleep last weekend, and she was a really beautiful woman. She was a gem. And she had a lot of sponsees, and one of her sponsees called me and asked me if I'd sponsor her, and that was a real honor. Anytime I'm asked, it's an honor, you know. I don't know, I'm overwhelmed. I'm just overwhelmed with the love that I receive here, and I talk about that a lot, but the old song, "Love Will Keep Us Together," it's very true, it's very true. It's the intimacy. I don't know anywhere where, except for here, where we can go and share something and we hardly are through with it and say, "I understand, I've been there. I know what it feels like." And that's like the fourth step, you know, when we share with someone our inventory. And we share the fifth step. And then we look at the sixth step, and old character defects and old behaviors come up, and old thinking comes up for me sometimes. And I'm snapping my finger, and I go, I know what that feels like, and you don't want to feel that, and you need to change right now. So I'll get on the phone and call someone. Or sometimes we're on the phone on Zoom, and we figure it out together. We figure it out together. We go, yeah, you know, that makes really good sense. And so we never have to be alone wherever we are. I've made my amends. I made my amends to my mom. My mom had Parkinson's disease, and it was a tough situation. I was the only child, so putting it, and she was in very many different places. And she finally, she said to me, she says, you know, I've always loved you. And I said, I know, I've always loved you too. And we made our amends to each other, and there was nothing left unsaid. And I was laying in bed, and she was down in Milledgeville, Montezuma, at a skilled living care, because we were running out of money. And she was down there, and I was thinking about her, and I got a phone call, and they said she just died. And it was best, because she was sick. She was pretty sick. And so right when she died, I was laying in bed, and this figure over me was my daddy. And he said, your mother's coming home. And I could see the yellow outline of his body look just like him. So I had that spiritual experience. God shows up right when we need him. Anytime I've had issues in my life, he's always been there. I've gotten through so many things. I've been through bankruptcy. I've been through miscarriages. I've been through marriages. I've been through divorces. I've been through, you know, when I was first new, I got fired on a job because I never did know how to be a secretary. That is certainly not my thing. And he asked me to book him a trip to Chicago, and I booked it to New York, and I just walked out of the room. I said, I'm bye. I left. It's not my thing. I need to be more a people person, you know, than sitting behind a typewriter, by the way. Because we didn't have anything. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have answering machines. We were talking about this earlier. You could either ride your bicycle, or you had a car, or take a bus to a meeting. If you wanted to talk to somebody, you go find them at the meeting, or you say, okay, tomorrow I'll meet you such and such. And you wouldn't have any other way to talk to them, and you'd hope they'd show up. So I think things were simpler back then. I didn't spend a lot of time on any electronics because I didn't have them. I had to learn how to talk. I learned how to communicate with other people, and I'm kind of grateful that happened because I was pretty shy. So it was nice not to have those things to distract me. I remember many things. I remember when Robert and I did a bid in the Shamrock Hilton at Ikipa in 1977. See, I come off in 77. You know, when he had hair and and I was skinnier and didn't wear big glasses. And we had a really, really good time. We had a good time, you know, making that bid and being involved. There's a lot of things that we did that where we just had a good time. We go out and eat. I remember going out and eat after a meeting, and they said, you are so skinny. So they feed me hot fudge sundaes from the Dunkin' Dine, yeah. And I remember doing that. I remember, just hanging out after a meeting and just talking and chit-chatting and starting up young people's groups and just having a really good time, going to many conventions and being participating in service. Service has really saved me. It's helped me so much. It's showed me how to have self-confidence, self-esteem, feeling a purpose, being able to speak up, feeling a part of, and just being a service of any capacity. I'm still of service. I was a PI chair for 2 years and did things for hospitals and institutions and taking meetings there, given informational pamphlets. I've been active in that in California. I'm always in service, and it doesn't matter what part of the country. We're 3,000 miles away. We all do the same thing. We all do the same thing. I've been to meetings in Europe. I've gone to lots of meetings in Europe, and they speak the same language, maybe a different dialect, but the same language, you know. I went to a meeting in Paris. They had an English-speaking meeting for French people. Mm-hmm. They sure did. And so I went to that. I've been to Thailand. I've been to Germany, all over the place, and I've had the privilege of going and seeing other parts of the country clean and sober, and I'm so grateful for that. There's so many things that I would never have been done. I never thought I'd see my 21st birthday. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing here telling you that life is full of surprises. Life gives us so much information if we just reach out our hand and we grab it and don't miss that miracle. You know, don't stop before the miracle. Because there's so many things that we can learn from each other. And if you're new, and you are new, there's a couple of people here new, get a sponsor. I felt so important to have a sponsor, somebody that can guide me in my recovery, show me how to live, give me information that I need to learn how to walk through. We have a blueprint for recovery right here. It is our map. And the steps are the map. Whether that's NA, CA, you know, GA, AA, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We have addiction is addiction is addiction. And for me, I mean, I used to have a shopping addiction, right? Until my pocketbook told me you can't do that no more. You know, I don't do that anymore. You know, I used to do that because I was upset, or I was emotionally distraught, or I was depressed. I thought, oh, this will fix me. It doesn't fix you. You still have to live with yourself on the inside. So I wish that I had more information. I can only tell you that everything that I've learned here, I've learned when I didn't want to learn it. I didn't want to know that. They said, well, you're going to either know it, or you're going to use, or you're going to drink. And I've shared this earlier, and a lot of people agree, a lot of people disagree with me, but I don't believe that relapse is part of recovery. And if you have relapse and you're back, but for the grace of God. For me, I don't know if I'd be here. I'd be dead. I know I'd be dead. I'm older, and I know that I wouldn't live. My body would not handle it. My mind would go crazy, and I wouldn't be able to come back. So I don't think that way. I think about, don't stop before the miracle. I still think about, what is it else you need to learn? And I think about, I want to live on this earth, and I want to be clean, and I want to be sober. I'm very grateful to be here. I found myself a little emotional tonight because of the special people that are here in the room that came here. I love you very much. Very, very much. And you tell me you've given me this, I'm going to tell you what you've given me. You've given me the unconditional love that I've always wanted. You've given me the opportunity to know you so that I know me better. You've given me the wonderment of what's next? What can we do next together? And I invite you to California. We do it different. When I moved, you know, when I moved away from here, I said, you guys don't do it right. And now I'm saying, well, that's the way it is. You know, they have speaker meetings, and then they have people that come and secretary the meeting, and then they get a speaker and they speak for 20 minutes and they open it up for discussion. It's real different. Here we do lead discussion, speak, you know, separate things. It's a little different. And my sponsor is awesome, and she's very loving, very kind. I have 9 sponsees, and I have all walks of life, And every one of them give me something that I want. Every one of them do. Every one of you. You've helped me to know me better. And that's what we talk about. We give it away to keep it. The last thing I think that I really want to say is that thank God that I have forgiveness in my life, that I can forgive myself, I can forgive other people. I don't give any drama in my life. I don't participate in drama. I participate only in solution, kindness, tolerance, patience, pause, and prayer. That's what I live by. And that's my integrity of my recovery. Because if I don't live in that way, then I will be an unhappy woman. And I want to be here to be a joy. So we trudge the road to happy destiny together. We live life on life's terms. And shall we meet again? And I want to thank you so much for listening. Thank you.